Hello and welcome to the Business Marketing Club podcast for B2B marketing people who want to get on and stay ahead. In each episode, we'll be offering insight and inspiration on a key current topic, advice on how to climb the career ladder, and top networking tips. My name's Dave Stevens, I'm a B2B marketer, and I'm chair of the Business Marketing Club Network. In this episode, I'll be speaking to account-based marketing practitioner and specialist at ServiceNow, Elise Miller, and head of account-based marketing at Fujitsu, Andrea Clatworthy, for their best case studies and what can be learned from them. Marketing leader callsign Joe Clegg will share some great B2B marketing examples and what he's taken from them to apply in his role. And Andrew Ainsworth will share a key lesson that he's taken on the journey to being marketing strategy manager at Sirium. Are you listening comfortably? Then we'll begin. Lots of B2B marketers talk about account-based marketing, but few practice it, and fewer still practice it well. I'm joined by account-based marketing practitioner and B2B marketing specialist at ServiceNow, Elise Miller. Elise, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave.
So there aren't huge numbers of examples of people practicing it well. Can you give us some examples of where account-based marketing has really proven itself?
Absolutely. I've got, I don't know how much time we've got, but I've got loads. So okay. I've picked a couple of highlights for
Thank you. Thank you.
The first one that springs to mind is probably one of the best cases of ABM work that we've done recently is around a financial services organization where we've collaborated directly with a customer to create a new solution. So identifying a champion within an account that we were trying to penetrate that was already involved and already ambitious about what he was trying to achieve and loved our products. And really working with them to shape our strategy, to shape the solution, the proposition, our value to the customer and how that all comes together. And the outcome of that was really creating an economic value map of how ServiceNow could support their growth.
Okay.
And the brilliant element of that is we then were able to use that and give that to our champion to actually leverage internally.
So I mean, that sounds great. So I guess there's lots of bits of that to kind of unpick. Firstly, you picked a champion rather than going in and working with an entire department or something like that. Was that a deliberate choice?
Absolutely. Actually, we find that people love our products. We have really high retention rates for our customers, but we still have a bit of a perception challenge within ServiceNow, so we're trying really heavily to address that. So finding a champion is not always difficult, and we use that as part of our strategy for account-based marketing where we can. So identifying that person was really key for us and leveraging that person to make sure that we're not only serving their needs and ambitions in order to progress them, promote them and really excite them about what we do, but also supporting our sales to close business faster.
And I guess if you kind of get a champion on board, that means that you've kind of got you've got a willing advocate then to try and spread the word further within the organisation.
Exactly. And the majority of the time, they already have an idea of who they'd like to speak to, what messages they're really confident in, and what levers do we need to pull to get our message across.
Okay.
And that's brilliant.
Okay. And I think, too, there's also the time it generally takes to get lots and lots of people on board with something like account-based marketing. So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like there's kind of almost a process of colonization that you've got going on there.
Yes, it's all about collaboration. We talk a lot about cross-functional collaboration, but I think collaboration with the customer is the next level of ABM. And actually, that's where a lot of the new solutions, new ideas, and really ambitious asks come from as well.
And Can you give us a little bit more information about the economic value model? How did that play into it?
Yes. So the economic value map or model, whichever way we choose to call it, is something that we create to show the total impact of our solution and the possibility that it could have on the customer. So not just looking at the products and what they bring, but actually looking at the value and how it touches everybody or everything within the organization to make the full impact. So articulating the value of the platform to the purposes of, you know, selling more, delivering value and great outcomes for our customers.
So it sounds thorough and therefore it sounds quite time consuming.
Oh, yes.
Why do you put all of that effort into being so comprehensive in the model that you provide?
So I think it comes down to big vision. So it's ensuring that we're not talking about technology, we're talking about real outcomes. And when you want to talk about real outcomes, you have to think big. Mm. And I think when you're talking to the C-suite, when you're looking at large deals, when you're looking at selling the vision and the values, you really have to start at the top. And when you're speaking to very senior people, decision makers and stakeholders, they don't want to know the nitty-gritty of how your product operates. They don't need to know the details of implementation. What they want to see is they want to see that you can support their business and you can support their strategy in ensuring that they get the outcomes that they need across the company.
Okay. And so then how was that model used or that map used?
So we leveraged our champion and we identified moments that mattered within this financial services organization's lifespan. Mm. So things like really key meetings, key events, and other milestones where he could publicize what he'd prepared. Because, you know, when you're working directly with a customer, you really want them to buy into the vision. You
sure.
want them to make it their own.
Yeah.
So essentially, it was all their idea. And we were just a supporting mechanism to make it happen. Mm. So they took it to meetings with them. They left handouts across the company. And they really helped us to promote it. Mm. And this way is the way that you can get it right in front of the right people at the right time. And I think that's the difference between maybe using digital, where you are hoping that the right people will see it and you're leveraging technology at the high level for awareness purposes, for building pipeline. And then this way, we were able to actually get in front of people and have a conversation about it.
So because it's hard copy and it's kind of physically...
It's physical, it's right in front of them, it supports the conversation and it reaches them from the internal source, so somebody they already trust, somebody they work with, so somebody who's championing on our behalf.
Mm. Okay, and what was the result?
The result was so twofold. One of them was a multi-million deal that's currently in progress. And secondly, a new solution that we developed for financial services. Because not only have we shaped a solution that's right for that customer, we actually looked at how could we leverage this across the whole industry. And what we shaped was the key thing that everybody wanted. So now it's the way that we articulate some of our financial services propositions to the whole of the market.
Okay. So would that be the kind of key learning that you think you took out from that, which isn't to be sniffed at in any way, shape or form, is it? So you've got something there that you can use with other FS businesses.
Exactly. So ask the customer what they need, create it with them, and then leverage it and scale it.
Cool. That sounds really impressive. We've got time, if you've got time, for one more example.
Absolutely. So another one is a really interesting one. So I've picked it from our global organization. So we'll focus on the US this time. When we first started our ABM practice at ServiceNow, we were set a challenge. And the challenge was to penetrate one of the pharmaceuticals and healthcare accounts that we had in America. And it was a bit of a difficult one because this customer was, they didn't really like us. They had a bit of bad perception about us.
Okay.
The CIO had some negative experiences. We've over-marketed to them before, so they actually blocked our IP. So we couldn't send them any comms. We couldn't touch them.
So you're not starting from a neutral point. You're starting from a very negative one.
Absolutely. And that's why it was really difficult. So, and I remember thinking about it and wondering how we're going to approach this and how we're going to prove the value.
Yeah.
Now, luckily, the company at the time was going through a huge acquisition of an insurer. And what they were trying to create was a completely new model of how consumers will consume healthcare services in the United States. And through this acquisition, we've discovered the insurer was already a really happy user of ServiceNow. And the CIO from the insurance company was going to be becoming the interim CIO of the whole new organization. And that gave us a great starting point. So we've got somebody that already loves us, and but we haven't really engaged with recently. So it's how do we bring that intelligence and how do we support them in that transition and make sure that that goes smoothly and we show the value of what they can do with ServiceNow.
So just within that, it might be worth just unpicking that a little bit, in the sense that there's a whole kind of discovery phase to what you're starting out on, where I guess you don't really know what you're going to find out.
No, absolutely not. So we did a lot of research on the healthcare organization to begin with. We worked with sales really closely to understand what's driving them, what are the challenges, what's the current perception, and where would we like to get to. And then during that research phase, that's when we identified that they were going through a huge acquisition.
Right.
And what they were looking to do was really transformative. It was really, really new. And two companies coming together, that can often be really difficult, particularly when you're forming something that's brand new. But this is our strong point. So this is where we knew that we could support them, we could really shine. So doing the research in the first organization, looking at the insurer and joining the dots was a really key part of that journey for us.
Okay, so you've worked out that there's this this kind of brilliant in into the organization. What next?
So we looked at the imperatives. So what they're trying to do, what's impacting them on the market level. We looked at the initiatives that they're trying to, how they're responding to them. And we looked at who's owning those. So what we found was that the CIO, the new CIO that was coming on board, that was already in touch with ServiceNow, was going to be the interim driving force for that whole transformation. So we leveraged our executives to connect the dots there on the same level, so peer-to-peer engagement.
Okay.
We used thought leadership and we used digital to really amplify that message to them. And we made sure that we used their language. So we'll look through the annual reports, the strategies, all of the news reports, a lot of press releases to find out what's really driving that acquisition.
There's a lot of research that goes into this, isn't
Absolutely.
There?
Yeah, you can't avoid it.
Yeah.
And then having done all of that work, we mapped out a journey of custom content. So what are we going to give our sales execs to support the transformative conversations that they need to be having? And then we armed them with all of this custom content to take to meetings. And that worked really, really well. So we've identified the right people, we've got the right content to them, we had the right story, and we had the awareness level over the top. And it resulted in some great conversation, more consultative conversations, and actually a first initial deal being closed. And what we were able to show is by mapping the journey from the research to the content to the awareness to the eventual closing of the opportunity is the first person that we profiled, the interim CIO, was the person who eventually signed the contract.
Brilliant.
So we could draw the line from that first engagement to that final point.
That's a great case study. So then what did you take away as learning from all of that?
Oh, a lot of things. So such a challenging case. But I think we found that ABM was absolutely the right methodology to be using, particularly in a case like this, when you're talking about large opportunity, when you're talking about a lot of things in stake. That was the right thing for us to do. And what we found also is leveraging multitude of nurture points, touch points, talking the company's language and using all of that information to make sure that we're really catering to their needs and we've got the right people that we're speaking to was instrumental to that.
You've been brilliant. ABM practitioner and B2B marketing specialist at ServiceNow, Elise Miller, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
My next guest is Andrea Clatworthy, who is head of account-based marketing at Fujitsu EMEA. Andrea, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Dave.
So we've been talking about account-based marketing to a number of guests, both in this episode and in previous episodes. And we kind of tend to focus a lot on the strategy side of things. I'm keen, before we drill into the case studies, to drill down to the tactics and get some sense from you as to things that practically work when you're looking at the tactics of ABM.
Great question, Dave. And this actually is a question that a lot of people ask me.
Okay.
So let me try and frame it correctly. Just so listeners are aware, we primarily do one-to-one strategic ABM rather than mass. We've been doing it for about 6 years or so. And to quite a lot of customers, actually, 30, 50, you know, so we've got the scars, you might say. But this tactics question, this is a great question, because actually there isn't a defined set of tactics that work best. It depends upon what you need to do with that account. So when we design an ABM plan, we think about objectives that cover three areas: relationships, reputation, and revenue. So if what you need to do is to reposition, then you're likely to use a different set of tactics than if you're trying to create new relationships with people.
Okay.
Personally, here's a good example probably. I have a dislike for customer newsletters, because quite often it's we need a newsletter declaration from the account team. But actually, if you step back and think about what you're trying to do here, you're trying to regularly communicate with a group of people, and a newsletter might not be the best format. Now, the reason I don't really like newsletters is because normally the first one's great because everyone's really up for it. The second one is a bit of a struggle, but the content's still quite good. The third one is just terrible, and the fourth one doesn't happen. You know, so they've kind of got a lifespan of their own. Now, having said that, I've seen some examples of where it's been used really well. So, for instance, the team with the ABM will set up an editorial board. They're really clear on the messaging they want to land and when. And they create something that looks beautiful, is easy to consume, has snackable content, and is fully trackable, which means it influences what you put in your next edition. And it never has a date on it. So you're not setting an expectation that there's one a month or one every 6 weeks or whatever frequency you want to go with.
So the thing that's different about that from your kind of standard newsletter is you've got some kind of interaction to shape future content that's kind of going on.
And it becomes a strategic tool rather than a quick tactic.
Yes, okay. And I guess also you're in a place where you can kind of dictate the length of the newsletter. You're not kind of setting a rod for your own back going forward a little bit as well.
Exactly.
Okay, so some newsletters work, but maybe not others. What are the tactics?
So increasingly, I think we need to recognise that there's an online, offline split between how people want to engage with the ecosystem that is the world of people that are going to sell them stuff to make their business work better. So recognising that actually, you know, as marketeers, we've moved almost everything digital. There's actually some really good success stories that are popping up where we're going offline again. So direct mail, for instance.
Yeah.
If you think about how often now do you receive a beautifully handwritten letter? Probably not very often, but if you did, you're likely to
remember it.
Then if you're using something like, you know, a 3D DM of some description that aligns with your overall communications plan, because you should be doing integrated campaign planning, and it's the same look and feel, or it's got a little gimmick that is just sparking some interest, is more creative than your competitors are doing, then chances are your intended audience will remember it.
Yeah.
And whatever the call to action might be,
so you're
they
doing,
might actually do it.
You're doing something that makes you distinctive, really.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, and these old school tactics were used because they worked.
Yeah, it'll be the pigeon will be back very, very soon. So that's a little bit on tactics. I'm keen to kind of move to kind of more general good best practice case studies now. So I think you've got one or two for us. So take us through how to do ABM, Andrea.
don't think I could do that in a 10-minute podcast. But let me share this particular story with you. And personally, I think this is lovely. We won an award with this, actually, at the B2B Marketing Awards in November last year. And it was a year-long campaign, ABM, into three transport organisations. So why is this ABM? We'd say, well, those three transport organisations all had the same imperatives and initiatives going on in their world, which meant that we could have a similar play to them. Mm. So therefore, it's like a mini cluster ABM. So year-long thing, okay. So we could already see about £300 million worth of bid in these three accounts. So our objectives were to support those, to support the buying journey of the customer, to build relationships with some of the stakeholders that we knew existed, but we didn't have the right level of relationship with them. And we knew they were either in the decision-making unit or they're an influencer. And actually, we also needed, in some instances, to reposition us from our heritage infrastructure view that customers had of us to something a little bit more digital transformational. So what did we do? Well, and this is why I love this. So we found a partner called Hack Partners, and we ran three 48-hour hackathons across various locations across Europe.
Okay.
Fantastic. So this organisation specialise in putting hackathons together. So they recruited the 80-odd hackers that played a massive role in this. And they worked on the real customer problems. So the customers were part of this process. And that's why it's so powerful, really. So these hackers, they worked through the night. So, on one particular of these three hackathons, they were on a train. Mm. You know, they were sleeping with their faces on their keyboards. They were working really, really hard over the space of 48 hours to come up with solutions to these real customer problems. And they were able to present them back to those customers at the end of that period. And then, of course, you know, stuff happened. Some things move into proof of concept. We made some investment. Others made some investment too. So these hackers just worked brilliantly. The camaraderie was fantastic. They drank a lot of Red Bull. Other energy drinks are Red Bull. But importantly, we spent three lots of 48 hours with our customer working on real problems that those customers had. So objectives achieved. We did our numbers. We found some more business through the process of that.
And I'm keen to just kind of go back to your kind of brushed away. Oh, objectives achieved. Oh. But actually, did you really measure your performance against those objectives? Because some of those objectives are kind of, it strikes me as quite difficult to be able to measure. So perhaps help us through that in a bit more detail.
Yeah, okay. So remember there's three R's: relationship, reputation and revenue. Mm. Okay. So from a reputational perspective, we'd reinvented ourselves as being quite innovative in our approach.
Okay.
And working at speed, hackathon speed, to come up with solutions that were real for our customers, that they were experiencing there and then. So that repositioned us from the legacy stuff. And how do we measure it? They told us. This is brilliant. We love it. Thank you so much. All right, so you can't get better
feedback than that, can you?
No, absolutely not. And on the relationship stuff, the key stakeholders that we wanted to engage with came along on the journey. So they were actually there, you know. So, you know, they're sharing a can of Red Bull, maybe not. But, you know, they're spending that time together meant that you are able to have conversations that you wouldn't normally have in the office.
So great case study, but what did you learn from it that you went on to apply elsewhere?
Well, we're doing some more.
Okay.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, we recognise that this is a model that works really well, and we're going to continue to do that, especially in this particular market.
And the model is the hackathon, is it?
Yeah. Okay. So it's the identifying the problem, using a hackathon style to quickly come up with solutions to those problems.
That's great. Andrea Clatworthy, Head of Account-Based Marketing at Fujitsu EMEA. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
B2B marketing is amazing, and it's time to celebrate it. Celebrate it because it's the toughest profession in business. Our profession is younger than FMCG. It's still got to prove itself. So you've got to prove yourself in a skeptical environment. Businesses don't get B2B marketing. And so you've got to persuade, explain and lead the way. Add to that the
the multiple internal stakeholders you've got to persuade and the multiple external customer groups you've got to convince. There's no longer just one buyer, there's many with different needs, opinions and expectations, and there's no one to help you. All the marketing professional bodies focus on FMCG rather than B2B. You're on your own. And given all of that, it's absolutely amazing that there's some really good B2B marketing out there right now. And I'm joined by marketing leader callsign Joe Clegg to look at some of it. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Oh yeah, thanks for having me.
So callsign, what's that then?
I suppose in a nutshell, we make identification secure and simple for large organizations around the world, predominantly banks. So if you think about when you're logging in to make a transaction or pay a new beneficiary, so that's paying money to someone else or whatever, we make sure that it is you who's making that transaction and not someone who's, you know, a fraudster or anything like that, basically.
Okay. So lots of good B2B marketing out there. What's caught your eye?
So I think I brought two different examples here. I think
okay.
The first one is I used to work for a company called Lloyd's Register. And this is one of those campaigns that they do after you've left and you think, oh, I wish I was part of that, because it was just a fantastic piece that actually looked at the technologies that are out there within the market and understood how they might have an effect within the business and then applied it back. So in this instance, it was, you know, the whole advent of virtual reality a couple of years ago. And everyone was sort of thinking, oh, how can we use this? And we saw a lot of marketers adopt it and go to events and trade shows with all these headsets. And it became a gimmick. Mm-hmm. And I think with stuff like this, it's often the case that they become the gimmick and get lost and fizzled out, and they lose the respect of within sort of internal stakeholders within the business. Mm. In LR's instance, they took it and applied it back into their sort of training department. So what they actually do at Lloyd's Register is one aspect of their product line is training for individuals who are on wind farms, oil rigs. It's a very difficult, very dangerous environment. And actually, a lot of classroom application of that is difficult to manage, difficult to teach. It's hard to actually be in that world, I suppose. And so bringing LR into that classroom training environment and being able to put on that headset and look at that world, you know, with objects falling, the dangers that are surrounding them in an oil rig, for example, I think it was a great application of taking a technology, understanding the environment, understanding the customer needs, and then applying that using the internal stakeholders within the business.
So kind of almost the first time for VR that had been used in a kind of non-gimmicky way.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's... I think, well, this, you know, this won an award, and my other example also won an award with the B2B Marketing Awards. Mm. And I think it really shows that you can sort of take these, what could be seen as a gimmick, and if you take a step back and look at the application and what your business does and what the customer needs are, you can actually turn it into a real profitable revenue line.
Mm. So do you know what the results were of Lloyd's applying the VR with this training?
I mean, I don't know the exact numbers. I mean, it happened after I left, but I knew there was they've seen a huge uptake in people taking the training, really great feedback, and it's actually really helped the sort of business grow in a very turbulent time, because it all happened at the same time as the oil price dropping, which made it difficult for a lot of contracts to come through. Mm. So I think it was a great way of actually understanding the turbulence in the market and applying that into a new area of revenue.
So as a marketer, what do you take from that that perhaps changes the way that you do the role of call sign?
I think for me, what I learned from this, I thought it was actually just a really good way of taking a step back. And when you get these new technologies and understanding how they could actually be applied and understanding what you do as an organization, taking that in and discussing it with internal stakeholders and actually working closely with sort of the product teams and other areas of the business to go, well, how can we apply this back in and create a better, more profitable product in one instance, or actually create a whole new product within another. And it's all about the customer needs and requirements and filling that gap and helping them there.
Because quite often with new technologies, there's kind of two stances you can take, right? So there's the stance of, oh, wow, it's shiny and new. I'm going to immediately embrace it and find something to do with it. And then there's the second one, which is, it's going to be a fad. I'm going to ignore it. I guess in this case, what's interesting is they looked hard at the technology and worked out actually the practical application for their business. So they didn't they neither ran to it nor ran from it. They kind of stood and looked hard.
Yeah, I think so. And I think looking at it from outside, it's almost looking at it and going, you know, what is it this technology actually does? Mm. And, you know, it allows people to go into a new world and experience that environment. Mm. Now, if you take that sort of rough concept and apply that back into a training course, you know, you're starting to see schools use VR to talk about, to show, you know, children the, you know, the Egyptian or Roman worlds. Mm. And it's the same application there, but in a business sense of going, actually allows people in a classroom environment to experience that landscape or world that they might not be able to do. And I don't think you can necessarily go into an oil rig and drop an object and go, look, this is the destruction it could cause. Mm. But you can win that virtual world. And I think it allows them to do that.
And that's quite a hard set of skills to apply. So I have to say, in my past, I was guilty of running towards VR and run towards it as a kind of sales opportunity. Or, you know, now the C-suite will be able to visualize what I've been thinking about all along. And what I hadn't considered was actually, well, VR is a headset. You put the headset on and it messes up your hair. And actually, people were so much more sort of conscious of their own image and how they looked that they didn't actually want to engage with the messaging that I was very proud of having created through the technology. But that whole kind of, oh, it's the headset and it's the interface and it's the way I feel as a human being when I use it is really, really hard to be able to predict when you're talking about a new technology.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just like wearing a cycle helmet. Most people don't wear a cycle helmet because they don't want to mess the gel up.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
But I think it is that. And I think, you know, sometimes you can get lucky. And I think in a classroom environment, you're not necessarily worried about that sort of interaction with other people in the same manner as you would do if you're on an event floor or in a conference room and you're trying to pitch that back in.
Yeah.
You know, I think in those instances, yeah. And also you're putting something in front of someone where they're going to look at it from an outsider in perspective. And I think sometimes that actually has the effect of what other people are going to think of me in this point in time, rather than actually I'm in this environment to use this product in this instance.
Great example. What's example number two?
This one is, I think it's just caught my eye and I thought this was just brilliant original. We always talk about sort of emotion in B2B. Mm. For me, I think it's more human. I think we're marketing to humans and be more human rather than just the emotional side of things. And so this is Tudder, which is Tinder for cows. I think just in general, I think it's a brilliant idea. But
you definitely have to stop here and explain what that
oh,
means.
Yeah. So it was a work between Hector Agritech and Octopus Group to create a dating app for livestock. So in this case, they were using cows.
I had no idea this was a needed thing.
Well, yeah, neither did I really. But when I, you know, took a step back and thought, okay, well, wow, this is brilliant. But then take a step back and go, okay, great. What is this? And it's very much a shouty, loud campaign. It's all about the PR. It's all about driving awareness. But their results were to drive awareness of this app and get the farming community to subscribe. And basically what the app does, it allows them to trade livestock within the app using data and algorithms to make it sort of, I suppose, easier and more manageable and more informed as well.
Okay.
But I think it's a tough target market. I mean, it's farmers. A lot of this sort of, we always talk about being personalized and data-driven and online targeting, but a farmer isn't necessarily going to go onto LinkedIn and see an advert and go, I'll download that 50-page PDF that talks about, you know, data algorithms within cow trading.
Yeah, I don't believe Wi-Fi and broadband in the middle of a field is quite as sophisticated as we would like yet.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why I think this is great, is that they went, okay, this, you know, our market is somewhere different. They're not necessarily going to be in some of the more prescriptive domains where, you know, desktop-based jobs are going to be. They're still a B2B audience, and we need to sort of drive that information across. But how can we do that in a much more original way? And I think what I felt like they've done is they've actually gone, well, they're humans, and what would engage them in that manner? And, you know, Tinder's great. Tinder. I think the novel of turning Tinder, you know, into Tinder for animals is just a really good hook to draw that attention. And then once you're in, I mean, I got informed. I understood that actually this was a needed product. And
So is it just a strap line, or does the whole of the marketing that they have created follow through on the headline of Tinder for cattle?
Well, yeah. So from what I read around it and what I've seen sort of in some of the videos they created was, you know, it was a push on Valentine's Day. Brilliant. So it's sort of a targeted press engagement and media engagement to sort of drive that awareness and try and get that sort of tier one coverage. But there was actually an app in the background that allowed you to sort of download, scroll through these cows, click on one, and that took you to the actual AgriTech app and started to inform and educate around there. And there was other press pieces around that that had a little more in depth around the trade press, as well as actually getting some farmers to talk to camera and do some pieces around that. So I think it was a much larger campaign, but we're using sort of a very large, very grandiose hook to bring people into that as well.
And for people interested in that, I should say that we will have the guys from Octopus Group coming on this podcast in a couple of weeks' time to talk about it in a bit more detail. So I shall pass on your praise. but what did you learn from seeing that the kind of you would now go about applying in your day-to-day work?
I think it goes back to that notion of sort of that being more human. And understanding your target audience and that they might not necessarily be in the areas that traditional methods might require. You know, we always talk about this sort of personalization and online targeted marketing. And I think there is definitely a place for that. My background's in digital. I'd be wrong to say it isn't. But I think sometimes the customer isn't necessarily always there. And I think in B2B, particularly when we're engaging with different businesses and there's much more sort of larger buyer groups within them, they're not always in the same place and it's not always the same message. And sometimes you need to stand out from a very saturated market of people doing the similar targeted messaging, download this PDF, here's very similar information. How can we learn to sort of take a step back, be a little bit more human and I suppose spark a reaction from them? They're wanting to engage in relationship with, you know, you as a brand. They're wanting to trust you as a brand. Let's build on that. Let's work on that. You know, that's what we're here for.
Marketing leader call sign Joe Clegg. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, Andrew Ainsworth shares a key lesson that he's taken on the journey to becoming marketing strategy manager at Cirium. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So what has made you the brilliant B2B marketer that you are today?
I think my journey into marketing might have been a little bit different to some of us.
Okay.
I started in a sales role. So I spent 18 months in a sales role. I got some great advice from a lecturer at university. Who said to me, for every one marketing role, there are 10 sales roles. So if you want to cut your teeth in business, jump into a sales role and find out what the market is really by speaking with customers, by picking up the phone, by putting yourself in uncomfortable situations.
Wow. So you started on the dark side. What sort of insight did you get from that?
Confidence to be able to speak to customers with clarity. Confidence to be able to address a point. But ultimately working towards the customer's problem. And what does that actually mean? A lot of salespeople will say, we are selling the problem. And a lot of product people will tell you, but here's my product and here's the features. When you're on the sales side of the organization, it's often the difference between the two and trying to marry those two areas together. So for me, that short 18 months of experience kind of made me as a marketeer think, right, how can I really give value to my sales organization? How can I make sure that I am aware that their job is based on targets? They've got monthly targets, quarterly targets, yearly targets. I really do believe in quick wins. I believe in the power of turning content around quickly and sharing that with salespeople. I think sometimes in marketing, we can look at the big picture and we can focus on things 6 to 12 or 18 months out. But from a business perspective, if you're a relatively small organization, things change so quickly and the sales organization are always looking for the now. Because in their eyes, they're thinking about new business targets and renewal targets.
So I'm really intrigued. How did you, as a salesperson, how did you look at the marketing department? Did you, you're kind of making it sound like you, the view would have been kind of they're not really focused on the things that matter to sales.
I was in a IT consultancy business and the marketing team there was very strong.
Right.
And they, I mean, they helped me a lot and it was very much a telemarketing role that I was undertaking. Because I did my degree in marketing, that was always the path I wanted to take.
Right. Okay.
And I struggled in the sales environment. I found it very difficult. the pressure of targets I found to be too much for my personality and too much for what I was really interested in at that point in my career. However, it gives me a lot more understanding of what the sales team are going through. So when we're having meetings about new leads or trying to engage our market, I think it allows me to kind of compromise and offer them different ideas and concepts to achieve goals. But yeah, I mean, I think I always wanted to work in marketing, and it was a way for me to get into a marketing role was through starting in a sales job.
And then you moved into marketing from that. And it I guess it's made you behave differently as a marketer because of that.
Yeah, I think I'm probably a little bit closer to the sales organisation than some others. I typically put my hand up to volunteer for projects such as social selling. So getting myself closer to that group because I wanted to be in front of the customer as well. And I wanted to listen to what the customer has to say. And equally, I wanted the sales organisation to be able to trust me and at least make them feel comfortable that I was going to go into those situations with a degree of confidence.
Sure. And I guess we always kind of leave this slot with kind of some advice or some sage recommendations for our listeners. So I guess what in terms of sort of advising people about how they would go about acquiring these skills, your advice is going to be Go and spend a semester in sales.
Yeah, I think if you're a graduate or you're just about to finish university or you're starting your career and you're looking at the jobs market and you're maybe struggling to find that perfect marketing role that fits what you want to do, I would advise to cut your teeth for 6 to 12 months or even a bit longer in a sales role. No one's going to criticise you, and it's a fantastic experience that will only make your CV look stronger going forward. I would say make sure that you're true to yourself, but also be bold with the sales organisation. And remember that you are the marketing professional in the conversation. Often you can be surrounded by 5, 6, 7, 8 salespeople who will be telling you what they think, but it's your job and to question, to offer alternatives, and to make sure that you believe in what you're saying and or communicate that with a degree of confidence in yourself. I think that's really important. And I always say, I've written down here, but just don't always say yes. Say no. Be proud of saying no. But with, you know, within reason.
Yeah.
Not all the time, but
absolutely not all the time. Marketing strategy manager of CVM, Andrew Ainsworth, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave. Cheers.
And that's it. That's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, Elise Miller, Andrea Clatworthy, Joe Clegg, and Andrew Ainsworth. And thanks to you for listening. Please do let us know what you thought of today's podcast. Give us a rating or review, or drop us a line at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. And if you've got something interesting, practical and visionary to share with our listeners, why not volunteer to be a guest on a future podcast? But no sales pitches, product demos, creds presentations or theoretical nonsense, please. That's not for this podcast. You could also think to join the Business Marketing Club for events, mentoring and thought leadership for the B2B marketing community. It costs just £100 to sign up for 1 year. So go on, it's really, really good value. I'm Dave Stevens. Thanks very much for listening.